And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are on this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. And happy Easter, everyone, all around the globe. This is our Easter show, which is going to obviously be a bit expanded. I think if you wanted to term what we're going to talk about this evening or this morning, it's going to be the concept of resurrection, coming back, renewal, all those springy things that are anchored in our ancient mythologies that are actually a part of our lives, even though we don't notice them most of the time, and are certainly on the forefront of many people's minds right now because desperately everyone wants in this crisis to, you know, reopen, to resurrect the national social fabric, heck, the international social fabric. And the questions, of course, arising around this pandemic is how and when is it safe to do so? I mean, regardless of your position on what's behind this, and I know there's a huge number of theories out there floating around. The internet has amplified people enormously and given voice to all kinds of very extreme ideas. I like evidence. Oh, I love testable evidence. Be that as it may, we are getting reports now which may feed directly into the conversation going on in New York and California and the rest of the country, to say nothing, of course, of Washington. When will it be possible and when will it be safely possible to begin to reopen the economy and for people to physically get back together? And without going into all the controversies swirling around testing and, you know, political agendas and all this, I want to direct you to a news item coming to us this evening from South Korea. If you remember, and what you're going to want to do is go to The Other Side of Midnight Radio with Pictures, and I'll tell you how to get there. You go to our URL, theothersideofmidnight.com, click on tonight's banner. There at the top, the one with the remarkable comparison of the image on the Shroud of Turin, and an artistic concept of what Christ looked like. We actually had a reaction at the bottom of the page, I believe, from someone who said, well, that can't be Christ because he had short hair. I'm kind of wondering, and I want to ask that person if they're listening, how do you know that? Anyway, we're going to be talking about resurrection and the idea of reopening society. I mean, we have never lived through a time in history when all of the planet was essentially closed down. 95% of Americans, according to a number of inputs, are doing what they need to do right now, and they're staying home. The other 5% could be a problem because, as with those crowded beaches in Florida several weeks ago, there's no better way to spread a virus in a population than to have people who are asymptomatic, who show no signs that they have anything going on, but to have them mingle with crowds and come, you know, within social distance, physical distance. And until we get a handle on that, all the other things are very problematic. Well, this news story coming from South Korea, where, remember, right after China, South Korea had the next biggest number of cases. They jumped on it right away. Within a week, they had a good test, which appeared to work most of the time. Again, with science, as we're learning every day, this is an imperfect science. We're learning brand new things about how this virus operates in the human body, how it causes incredible illness and fatalities in some people, and other people apparently can walk around carrying the virus and they show no symptoms at all, which is a really remarkable medical statement to be able to make. And I'm going to be asking our guests this evening to kind of delve more into that because, frankly, epidemiology is not one of those things that I ever really studied in depth. So this is a time for learning. But the thing that we're all learning is that even the best research can get turned on its head with further research. The hope has been, as with previous epidemics and outbreaks of this nature, that once you get the disease, once you have successfully fought off the disease, your body, your bloodstream will carry antibodies. That if you're exposed to the disease again, they will voraciously go out and gobble up the invaders and you won't get sick. The way you figure that out is, A, you look for antibodies in the blood. That's an antibody test, which is tried and true and very simple and has worked, you know, throughout the last several decades very, very well. And the other way is that you see if and when patients are re-exposed to the original illness, the original disease, that they don't become reinfected. In Korea, as of, and remember, this is a very fast-moving story, so this could be, again, obviated in the next 24 hours as new data comes in, but something like 91 of South Korean patients who were certified with two tests within 24 hours of each other that both said that they had gotten over the disease and they were no longer carriers of the virus, they're now testing positive again. Now, we don't know. Again, there is so much uncertainty. Everything every expert or every person in a position of authority or every guy on the radio is saying must be taken with a grain of salt because we're living and moving in very uncertain territory, incredibly uncertain. I mean, for most people who think that when a scientist says something, that's, you know, kind of like God speaking, not. Scientists are just people. Research is just a human activity. It has enormous brackets for errors, certainly at the beginning of a totally unexpected event for which nobody is prepared, certainly biologically in terms of immunity. Anyway, the South Koreans have announced as of a couple days ago that 91 patients certified free of the virus, well enough to go home, resume their normal lives, have now been tested, and they have the virus again. They don't have symptoms, but they're carrying the live virus. What does this mean? Does this mean that this epidemiology of illness and then recovery and then antibodies is not true in the case of this particular virus? Well, I don't know, so I'm going to ask our resident medical expert in a few minutes here, and we'll hopefully find out more. Item number two, again, what you want to do is go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on tonight's banner for Sunday, Easter. Happy Easter, everyone. That will take you to the guest page. Right under the guest page, you will see two little links which say fast links to items for me and for Dr. Silverman. Click on Richard, that's mine. Go down to number two. I've you know, discussed this a couple of times in the last week or two. Doctors are rethinking a very important part of this problem in terms of treatment, the ventilators. And we've discussed this at length, certainly on last night's show. Are the ventilators that we're using, that the medical community is using to attempt to desperately save the most critical COVID-19 patients, are they in fact being used the wrong way? Are they in fact the wrong technology? You're going to want to look carefully at this article, because it goes through in some depth the fact that doctors in hospitals all over the country are now looking at the data and the fact that most of the time when they have to put a patient with COVID on a ventilator, that's the end of the story. The patient never comes off the ventilator. They die. I mean, this is horrible. They're now beginning to wonder if the ventilator themselves, by basically, you know, pushing air into the lungs, like blowing up a tire, is the wrong treatment for providing the patient oxygen at a time when their lungs are being ravaged at the cellular level by the virus and your immune system counterattack, which causes intense inflammation. So there's been a kind of a different approach using corticosteroids and some other drugs to try to reduce the inflammation. They're looking at oxygen perfusion techniques that do not involve high pressure. And I know this because, again, the way we operate here is that I get a piece of information, then I try to find corollary information. Well, we have a doctor, a source, inside perhaps the most beleaguered hospital on the planet right now, the Elmhurst Hospital there in Queens, in New York. and she is reporting that there has been intense discussion among their medical staff, and they're switching from ventilator procedures to medical procedures involving certain drugs, certain anti-inflammatories, and they're having very significant success. So again, this goes back to nobody knows, and I'm including doctors in this, nobody knows when they're confronted with a totally unknown situation what to do. Everyone tries from their best previous experience, but if it truly is a novel virus, and I use that term at many different levels, then the fact that early patients may have suffered inadvertently because they're on the wrong treatment protocol, i.e. ventilators that are doing more damage than good. Again, we're watching a process unfolding irregardless, as my grandmother would have said someday, to the actual cause of how this pandemic has broken out all around the world. Item number three. Remember how we did a show, you know, a week or so ago about the positive aspects, the kind of the silver lining, the good news behind the horrible news? Well, here's an item. Number three. China, the Chinese government, has now officially reclassified dogs and cats as pets, not livestock, not to be sold at these so-called wet markets or sold in supermarkets or sold as, you know, household meats to be taken home and consumed. This is a stunning, important breakthrough. And animal rights organizations around the world are lauding the Chinese. Obviously, this has to be followed up to make sure that the new laws are enacted, are pursued, are enforced. But this is one of those rays of light behind the dark clouds, because, of course, we all know that in many, many other parts of the world, most of the world, dogs and cats are considered members of your extended family. And so this is an extraordinary positive step, and only one of many we're going to be citing in the days and weeks to come. Item number four. Now, I talked about this last night with Chandra Wickramasinghe, who is probably the world's foremost exobiologist. He has been doing work in this field for decades, pioneering, stunning work, which if you missed last night's show, you're going to want to join Club 19.5 because you're going to want to listen to this maybe a couple of times. This is really, really critical. A, because we discussed an alternative model, again, backed up by real scientific data, including data from collaborators with Dr. Wickramasinghe from inside China regarding where this outbreak first occurred in Wuhan, and some very interesting extraterrestrial information that is supporting the idea that this virus, this pandemic, this scourge, has not been released on the human race from anybody down here on the planet. But in fact, it could have come from outer space. And there's decades of research that Dr. Wickramasinghe and his colleagues have been pursuing, including initial telescopic studies and then ending up with actual samples of bacteria and viruses from above the Earth's atmosphere, from spacecraft, from high-altitude balloons, and most intriguingly, and he co-authored a paper with a Russian scientist who was in charge of this investigation many, many months ago in Russia, that they were able to analyze swabs taken of the exterior of the International Space Station, and they found all kinds of intriguing and extraordinary microorganisms, including algae. And of course, the question is, this thing is orbiting the Earth 250 miles up. How the heck did anything from Earth get up through space beyond the atmosphere where there's no wind, where you have sleeting solar radiations and, you know, very harsh ultraviolets, et cetera, et cetera? How did these microorganisms get from the planet to the surface of the space station to be swabbed and then brought inside and analyzed to turn out essentially to be life forms that no one could possibly have expected in the zero atmosphere and cold and heat of outer space. Well, the conventional scientists looking at this data are basically saying, oh, it's got to be contamination from the Earth. There must be air currents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas Dr. Wickramasinghe's data, going back again, as I said, decades, says very forthrightly that, in fact, this could be another example of collection of microorganisms already in space, in the solar system, orbiting the sun, and among other things, the effluvia from comets, from the dust and the other, you know, fine particles being released as comets vaporize in the heat of the sun and the Earth crosses their dust-filled orbits. Again, this is a model that the coronavirus did not come to us from some lab, some, you know, or some bat or pangolin down here, but in fact is part of a regular or semi-regular series of epidemics that arise not from terrestrial sources, but from a new influx of their origination point, which is these interplanetary clouds of dust particles and microorganisms floating through the solar system. I mean, again, this is so stunning, and the data is so overwhelming when you look at what Dr. Wickramasinghe has presented, but it's been ignored. In fact, it has been very, very systematically downplayed and poo-pooed and relegated to the dustbin of history in some minds by mainstream academia for reasons that are not all that clear. Because if, in fact, we've closed down the world because this thing came to us from outer space, wouldn't it behoove world governments to, in fact, take a really hard look, maybe set up international committees, maybe send missions into orbit to actually look for this kind of signature and, you know, develop protocols, if it happens again, to safeguard against it, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that's all of the things that we discussed last night. Now, the thing which was a surprise, which was a very, very elegant surprise to me, is that when I brought up item number 4, that the Curiosity rover, a la NASA, is reporting a new mystery on Mars, companioning with the rising and falling seasonal measurements of methane, which, as most of you probably know, is an indicator of biology here on Earth. Most of the methane on Earth comes from biology, from microorganisms, from, yes, cows. That's not an urban legend. That's real. Cows, you know, when they do their thing, they release a lot of methane all over the planet. It goes away. It's broken up by sunlight, by ultraviolet. So it has a half-life, something like, you know, a couple of hundred years. Well, even worse conditions exist for naked methane, if I can use that term, on Mars. But for some reason, methane on Mars is hanging around, and it's rising and falling in a seasonal cycle with the Martian spring and summer and winter. That, of course, would be an indicator on Earth of the magic B word, biology. Well, they got a new mystery, and that's what we're talking about in the NASA press release in item number 4, because there is now a rising and falling measured curve from the instruments in Curiosity, the SAM instrument in particular, of oxygen levels. Very small oxygen levels in the overwhelmingly CO2 atmosphere of Mars, they're rising and falling, and their rising and falling is in synchronization with the methane. So I really was very, how should I say, conservative last night when I kind of sprung this data on Dr. Wickramasinghe, and I said, well, what do you think is causing this? And I was so gratified that his instant answer was, well, it's got to be biology. There's living things on Mars. So what I'm here tonight on basically, you know, Easter Eve to tell you is that NASA has found evidence strongly supporting the idea of current microbial life on Mars, and they don't know how to tell us. And we talked about this extensively in last night's show, so I won't reiterate it. But go and read that press release and see if, before you listen to the Chandra Show, you can pick out the key words in the NASA release, which, again, in the Emily Dickinson fashion of tell all the truth, but tell it slant. NASA in this is being extraordinarily Emily Dickinson. And maybe the most gratifying part of my conversation with Dr. Wickramasinghe last night was when I mentioned Emily Dickinson and made the comparison, he said, ah, yes, of course. So he knows about Dickinson and her approach to life and metaphysics and reality, and he agrees NASA is telling us the truth, but they're telling it between the lines. Okay, in a similar vein, as all this is going down, you know, the world is closing down because of virus, people are panicked, people are uncertain as to what to do, who to trust, who to listen to, what authority figures to follow or not follow, the president, our president, quietly signed another executive order, opening up the moon to both government and private enterprise, I'd use that term advisedly, mining. Let me say that again. President Trump has now opened up the moon legally in the United States to mining by corporations and government agencies, which, of course, flies right in the face of the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. And we discussed a bit of that last night with Chandra. We'll be discussing this on future programs as these plans become more solidified and are put out there in the public. But this, what this really means to me, given that there's no reason why you would mine something on the moon, I know the helium-3 discussion up and down, back and forth. I'll just remind everybody that there are no helium-3 nuclear fusion reactors anywhere on Earth or anywhere actually planned in terms of engineering for the next 50 or so years, so that's just a canard. What could the president really be by mining the moon? Could it possibly be the artificial artifacts, the remnants of an ancient civilization that we found in the NASA data and other data sets like the Chinese and the Japanese, etc., that are literally now found all over the moon in those images, those data sets? As we say with great vigor, stay tuned. Finally, this May, in the next few weeks, we're going to be regaled, so astronomers have told us, with a bright comet, ATLAS, which is an acronym for the observatory in Hawaii, the NASA observatory, which actually first spotted this thing about a year ago. The predictions now for it being one of the most spectacular comets of the 21st century so far may not come to pass after all. It appears to be disintegrating. And I just thought it was kind of interesting that in an era where, according to the Wickramasinghe model and data sets, the coronavirus could indeed have come as the detritus of a comet crossing Earth's orbital path, the idea that we may have a spectacular comet zipping through the inner solar system in the next few weeks to be visible, certainly in the northern hemisphere, while everyone is locked down, somewhat of a misnomer, is an intriguing coincidence. Well, there now is some evidence that maybe Comet Atlas is not going to perform as most comets recently have not done as advertised, and so we're going to be keeping an eye on this. We'll follow it in the coming weeks. We'll give you updates, and if in fact it is going to become visible after all, we will give you coordinates and instructions for where to look so that you can be as awed as I am always awed by looking at the objects streaming around the sun in the solar system through a telescope or even with the naked eye. With that said, I want to introduce our guest. This is going to be a really intriguing conversation because Dr. Andrew Silberman is a leading scientific expert on analysis of the Shroud of Turin. He's also a medical doctor with a background in physics. For over 30 years, Dr. Silberman has been conducting research on the mind-matter continuum, near-death experiences, and the Shroud. He's presented his findings in peer-reviewed scientific papers and international scientific conferences. He was one of three panelists for discussion on the nature of consciousness at the 33rd Annual Conference of the Society for Scientific Exploration. Dr. Silberman lives in Britain and is with us this evening all across the pond. Dr. Silberman, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
So where should we dive in? Okay, let me move on, because you've written a really remarkable book, and we're going to be dipping in and out of that book at some length. Let me back up on a screen here. I don't know who could be calling me in the middle of the night here on the show, because they know the hours, and they know that we shouldn't be doing that. But you have written a very intriguing book called A Burst of Conscious Light. What was the background to that? I mean, you're a medical doctor, you're trained as a physicist. When did you get intrigued with the idea of consciousness?
Well, you see, I've always been fascinated by consciousness, but the start of me writing the book was to do with my interest in the Turin Shroud and the image upon it. And when I was only just a teenager, I saw a award-winning documentary by someone called David Rolfe called The Silent Witness, which was about the 1978 collaborative scientific study on the Shroud that was done by many people from NASA, from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, from Los Alamos, expert physicists who were allowed a lot of time to look at the Shroud and study it in many scientific ways. And it was, many of them went there thinking that they were going to sort of see the brushstrokes, as it were, and then go home, because they assumed that this must be just like many other, in quotes, religious relics. But they found that actually this wasn't something that could be accounted for as having been done by an artist or a hoaxer. In fact, they couldn't account for how anyone would be able to do that, even with 20th or 20, now with 21st century technology, no one can account for how such an image could have been fabricated. And the only consistent explanation that they came up with how the image could have been formed was that it was a short, intense burst of radiant energy that came from the dead body of the man who had been wrapped in the Shroud. And so what fascinated me was, if this is what happened, then how did such a thing happen? And with all the evidence pointing to it having been the historical Jesus of Nazareth, who was the man who was wrapped in the Shroud, I just, you know, wondered, is there some correlation here that might be related to, you know, what he taught and how he lived, that might show us how such a thing was possible for a human being? And I should say right from the outset that I don't come at this from a religious position. In fact, you know, I wasn't brought up as a Christian, or I'm not part of any denomination, but I was just fascinated looking at it rationally, at how such a thing would be possible. And it did occur to me, as it may have done to others, that, you know, to understand such a thing, we need to look deeper into the nature of what material reality and consciousness, and how the two might be related, to understand how such a phenomenon could have occurred.
Perfect. Well, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. That was the perfect setup for the next 2.5 hours of The Other Side of Midnight. My guest is Dr. Andrew Silberman, medical doctor, physicist, and he began looking at the idea of, are we more than just physical 3D objects in terms of consciousness, by way of an analysis of the infamous Shroud of Turin. Is it possible? Is it possible indeed? Whoops, sorry about that, folks. Is it possible that, in fact, there is a remarkable connection between these two ideas, these two realities? Stay tuned. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. Happy Easter, everyone.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional timescale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning is Dr. Andrew Silberman, coming to us from England. He's a medical doctor, he's a physicist, and he got into this entire discussion by way of the analysis of the Shroud of Turin. Dr. Silberman, you said something very interesting. You said that this team put together, what, back in the 1970s?
70s.
In the 70s. That they went into this kind of expecting to find a hoax with brushstrokes and all that, maybe done by Da Vinci is one theory that I've heard. And they were kind of baffled by the fact that when you look microscopically at the fibers of the linen of the shroud, there are no brushstrokes to be seen. Can you kind of amplify on that?
Yeah, I mean, I doubt they would have been suspecting by Da Vinci, because the history of the shroud is, you know, from way before Da Vinci was born. But yes. So basically, if you look at the shroud on a magnified view, photo micrographs of the shroud, you can see that basically there are different features that you can see on the shroud. There's the blood stains on there. There's some water marks on there, and also there's some burn marks on there, but also there's the body image of a man. Now, if you look at the blood stains under a photomicrograph, and sort of through a microscope that takes a photograph, you see, as you would expect, that the blood has soaked through into the cloth, and there are fibers matted together. But if
you say blood stains. Do we know now that they're bloodstains from this analysis?
That's right. The study that was done back in 1978 by the scientists at the time that looked chemically at the stains and their constituency and did find that it is actually blood. Yes, and as you would expect, you see that the fibers there are matted together because the blood has soaked through into the cloth. But where the actual image of the body is, it's only on the outermost surface fibrils, where one fibril goes underneath another. It's only on the surface of that, so that it's not on the bit where it goes, the part where it goes underneath.
Oh, so and where the fibers in the shadow, there is no image. But where it's exposed on the surface, there is an image.
The image and the thickness of the image is only 200 nanometers, which is 1/5,000th of a millimeter in thickness. And when you study it chemically, it doesn't consist of anything that's been added to the cloth. It's not paint or pigment or anything that's been added. What it is a chemical change that has occurred called oxidation and dehydration, which turns it a kind of sepia yellow hue, which is quite similar to what happens to paper when it's exposed to sunlight, you know, how it turns slightly yellow.
Is this a heat process or a photochemical process?
Well, it appears that some people may have taken on the clue of the fact that it's similar to what happens from sunlight, because it's actually, and it may have been caused by a ultraviolet light. Now, you see, there was a, but not sunlight. There was a, there's been a lot of study on this in the Atomic Energy Institute in Italy, in Frascati, by several eminent researchers, headed by Dr. Paolo Di Lazzaro, who is a physicist there. And what they found is that the only way that they've been able to make similar changes to a linen cloth microscopically is by very short, intense burst of radiation from an ultraviolet laser.
Oh my gosh, that intensity.
Yes.
That must be like thousands of watts per square inch or per square centimeter.
Well, what they calculated is that if the whole image formed in that way, yes, it would have been thousands of billions of watts of power that would have done this, which isn't possible even with today's technology. Now, just to be
And hang on. We're talking about a cloth that measures, 14 feet wrapped around the front and the back of this body. And the idea is that if it was Christ, if it was supernatural, if it was beyond current physics, something happened to that body wrapped in that cloth, and it issued an intense burst of energy, of light, of ultraviolet, and that caused the image, the 3D image, to singe or to affect the top linen fibers pointing toward the body, right?
Well, yes, I would say that it does. There is evidence that it was Jesus of Nazareth who was the man who was wrapped in the shroud. Actually, I'm sure we'll come to this later, but I'm not using the word supernatural because, you see, I believe what he was demonstrating is something that is completely natural in the sense that...
I'm kind of glad you made that distinction because I equally hate the term paranormal. Because I think if you have scientific evidence for things that are, quote, paranormal, they become normal because they're part of an inclusive, expanding realm of physics that we just don't know at the moment.
Yes. Well, I mean, the aim of the book is to show how that connection might work between mind and matter, or at least to give clues in the direction that that's worth looking to try to understand that phenomenon. You see, for example, parapsychology researchers will do lots of experiments to see whether they can detect any evidence of extrasensory perception or mind over matter, which are the two sides of the coin, if you like, of the so-called paranormal. But what I think bears stating, and this is one of the points that I made in the Society for Scientific Exploration conference that you alluded to at the start in the introduction, is that actually all perception is extrasensory because senses don't perceive. A camera is pretty much like an eye. The processing unit is a bit like a brain in the camera, but the camera doesn't see what it's looking at. People say that we have consciousness because we have self-awareness, because the brain is processing information about itself, but the camera is processing information about itself if it videos its reflection. Does that mean it's aware? Does that mean it's murder if you switch the camera off? Yeah, so all perception is extrasensory, and if there is such a thing as free will, and in the book I demonstrate evidence of why there is such a thing as free will, well, that's mind over matter. So you see, extrasensory perception and mind over matter aren't just real, but they are the fundamental nature of our very existence. In every single moment of our existence and experience is a testament to both of them.
Interesting point. So, very interesting. Mm. Okay, back to the shroud. So the amount of energy required to affect these fibers is off scale.
Well, not the energy, the power. I have to make a distinction here between power and energy.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
You see, power is the rate of transfer of energy. So it all happened very quickly. But if it had been a huge amount of energy, there'd be no cloth left. There'd be tomb left, probably. It's just a very rapid transfer of energy rather than a huge amount of energy that defines the fact that large amounts of power are involved.
Okay, so that's your kind of scientific starting point, that the shroud is not a simple, painted cloth. How did you personally get involved in the analysis? Because, of course, those studies were done decades ago, and actually I believe I had a guest on a couple of years ago who was a member of the original team, but mm-hmm. you know, the fact that scientific people all over the world were looking at these results, what drew you in as a doctor and a physicist?
Well, I've studied physics. I'm not actually working as a physicist, but so what drew me in, as I say, was looking at the documentary about the research that had been done by the STIRP team, by the Shroud of Turin mm-hmm. research project called the Silent Witness. And then at that time, I was just still at school, but then. When I was a medical student, I was studying a science degree as part of my as an extra course within my medical degree, and at that time was when the carbon dating was reported in the journal Nature, and I used to read Nature every week, and so I saw this when it came out, and I was fascinated by a table of data that was in the original Nature article. Which to anyone looking at this with the modicum of mathematical knowledge shows that actually the three labs that dated this tiny bit of portion of the cloth from the shroud came out with different statistically different answers, and this wasn't really addressed by the report. And then I later heard that there was some groundbreaking research by a couple in the States, Sue Benford and Joe Marino, who showed that the corner of the cloth that the sample was taken from for the carbon dating had actually been repaired much later with much more recent material, and in fact the majority of the material that was dated was not part of the original shroud. It was added later, which is what caused the apparent medieval date.
Okay, let me stop you there, because I'm a suspicious person.
Yes.
If they were choosing portions of the cloth for the radiocarbon dating, was it just accident that they chose the medieval patches? Was that by political design? Did someone not want real evidence as to the real age of the cloth? I understand these are kind of controversial questions, but that's the first thing that came to mind. How could scientists make such a mistake when it was obvious that the cloth had been repaired?
Sure. I mean, I wouldn't like to make accusations, because I always like to think people are innocent unless proven guilty. But definitely at the very least, what it shows is that a level of incompetence that the people who were doing the arranging the dating didn't really listen to the experts on the shroud, who were the STIRP team, the Shroud of Turin Research Project, that had done the research 10 years earlier, and didn't take guidance from them because if they had, they would probably have sampled more than one part of the cloth,
I would think. I mean, wouldn't that be just basic science?
Yes. So it wasn't really a very scientific project that, in the end, the carbon dating, and the results were not. It didn't follow protocol. They communicated during the study, although there were supposed to be three independent labs, and their actual data themselves don't hold up when you look at it, because of the statistical difference between the datings from the different labs.
Okay, we're going to jump back and forth because, you know, I have this curiosity bump, and when you say something provocative, I want to ask a question right away.
Sure.
Have there been any upgraded radiocarbon samples that actually measure the rest of the cloth?
Well, there is a report of one that that was arranged by a scientist from Los Alamos, but unfortunately, we don't have the full evidence of where it was done and how and so on that we can actually rely on it to be able to say safely. But lots of us have been there, but that did make it look a lot older. But many of us in the shroud research community have been lobbying the church to allow more scientific research to be done on the Turin shroud, but so far, you know, without any results.
So do you think that's because the church wants this to remain in ambiguity? because remember, they're not into science, they're into, you know, fathering the flock. So do they want this to remain kind of in limbo?
Well, you see, I wouldn't be able to know really what their motivation is. Actually, I went to a presentation by Bruna Barberis, who is one of the people who advises the church about the scientific aspects of the Shroud, Professor Barberis, and he was saying, you know, a lot of people ask me, when is the carbon dating going to be done again? And I just have three answers for the three things I have to tell you. One is the Shroud now belongs to the Pope. The second one is I am not the Pope. And the third one is I will never be the Pope. So really, unless the Vatican authorizes it, there can't be any more carbon dating on it, unfortunately. But
hang on. Let me follow up a point. Between the 70s and now, the 21st century, the second, third decade, I guess, of the 21st century, science, physics, analytical technology for radiocarbon dating has advanced incredibly. I mean, we can now do radiocarbon tests on one fiber. One fiber. You don't have to take a sample. One, you know, fiber of cloth. So why would the Pope, you know, because the buck stops with him, you just said, why would the Pope not want that ambiguity resolved when it would result in zero damage to the Shroud as a whole?
Yes, I can't answer for him, and I don't know what his motivation is, but interestingly...
Well, what's the scuttlebutt? I mean, you're talking to a bunch of other researchers. You guys obviously talk to each other a lot. You know, we don't need to be politically shy. Why do you think that misnomer, that obviously scientifically wrong early conclusion, because they chose to sample only the medieval part of the, you know, remodeled cloth or repaired cloth, why do you think the Pope wants that to stand?
Maybe he wants it to stand. I don't even know how much attention he pays to the Shroud at all. See, this is the problem with speculating. What I wanted to say is that, interestingly, one of the people who was in the research team that did the radiocarbon dating was from the University of Oxford. He actually now actually heads the radiocarbon dating lab there, and he went on the record in another documentary that David Rolfe did for the BBC of saying that there's so much evidence that points to a much earlier origin of the Shroud than the carbon dating suggests, that we really, more research is needed to give an overall view of, that gives us an understanding of what he referred to as this intriguing cloth. So that although he had been in part of the actual carbon dating team, he concedes that there's so much evidence now that suggests that the Shroud could actually be much older than that.
If I remember correctly, among the things that they did, this team in the 70s, which I believe was spearheaded by some physicists up here in New Mexico at Los Alamos, they took basically Scotch tape, and they went over a good portion of the Shroud looking for pollen, looking for dust, looking for, you know, trace evidence of where it had been, you know, how it had traveled from wherever it originally was created to the Vatican, that kind of thing. I would have thought they would have picked up some loose fibers in that process, and those should be carefully stored somewhere.
Yes, there may be, but you see, the thing is that if there were enough to do a carbon dating on, then there would be, whatever it shows, there would be people who say, well, where is the chain of evidence showing that this actually, the provenance, that this has actually come from the Shroud and hasn't come from someone who has a vested interest in saying that it's either ancient or modern. You see, so that's why it really... I think if there is going to be more dating to be done, then it would need to come through the auspices of the church allowing more samples to be taken.
Because if I again remember their protocol, they photographed extensively, overwhelmingly every step of their process, And when they were taking these scotch tape, I'm using the term scotch tape. It was a more, you know, refined tape. But the idea was to remove.
Mylar, I believe it's called.
Okay. Yeah. They recorded, like NASA recording where they gathered samples on the moon, they recorded where they took the tape, you know, patches, the adhesion tests. They then stored all of them in labeled vials, that kind of thing. So it would be pretty easy to reconstruct a paper trail, a chain of evidence, if you found on those tapes particular linen fibers that were not in the area that was fixed by those medieval nuns.
Sure. I mean, a lot of the material, of course, on those tapes was by design. They were picking up contamination that occurred on the shroud beforehand, after, more recently, for example, the pollen and so on. Again, there would still be the question of the provenance and so on. But yeah, I think it would probably need, even with modern technology, it would still need a larger sample than you know, one or two fibrils from the cloth.
Well, again,
which are the components of the fiber.
I'm very used to dealing with controversial science, having dealt with NASA for many, many decades. If some enterprising researchers, even outside, were able to go to the samples that were carefully stored and do that test with those possibly, you know, removed loose fibers, at the very least it would create such a political controversy that then the Pope would have to answer. He would have to provide a plausible reason why you couldn't do the same thing now with just a few fibers for a modern, accurate, you know, paper trail test. So politically, remember, it's always comes down to politics.
Yes.
You could force the Vatican to do science in the 21st century like they did it in the 20th.
Yes, I don't know, possibly.
Okay, let's move on. So when you got access to this data, what was your first reaction? I mean, did you grow up thinking about the shroud a lot? Or, I mean, you're not a Catholic, you said you're not religious. So why were you so captivated by this anomaly that it really kind of became a central focus of your interest?
Yes, as I say, the interest was how the image could have got there when it can't be made now, even with modern technology. How did it get there then? And then when I saw as a student, I saw back in the late 80s that the carbon dating that they had done didn't really hold water. And then, you see, I started to write about my ideas about the shroud, and originally it was going to be a book about the shroud. And then I realized that really to do this subject justice, to understand how such a phenomenon could have occurred, can't be understood, I believe, in isolation. As I say, you have to see it in a broader aspect of trying to understand the nature of what a human being is, and to try to understand consciousness and matter and how the two might be connected. And I studied, for example, near-death experiences, which point to the fact that that consciousness cannot be a product of the brain, because the brain stops and consciousness continues. And I saw the evidence in quantum physics as well that led many of the founders of quantum theory and some current quantum researchers, including notably eminent professor at the University of Stanford, Andre Linder, to say that consciousness itself is something fundamental, that it's not a product of matter, but in fact it could be the other way around, that matter is a product of consciousness.
Okay. So we're not discussing miracles, right?
Exactly.
We're discussing unknown physics. Can you kind of differentiate that?
Certainly. As I say, if you consider the nature of what people usually define as supernatural, they tend to mean extrasensory perception, mind over matter, but yet every time we exercise our free will and make a decision, that is our mind influencing matter. Now, to tie this in, to try to understand the nature of matter, one also has to understand about space and time. Now, the interesting time is fascinating because in the equations of physics, there's no such thing as a present, if you like, as a moment that we call now. And neither is there a flow of time or even, in a way, a direction of time, such as we experience as conscious beings. For example, eminent Professor Roger Penrose said that it's only for consciousness that time needs to flow at all. There's no flow in the equations of physics which would have the whole of the history of the universe from the Big Bang through to the heat death of the universe could all be on one diagram all together as one blob, if you like. And so this is what led, for example, the person, one of the founders of quantum theory, Erwin Schrödinger, to realize that mind, consciousness, is always now, that actually it's the present is actually made real because of our consciousness, and therefore time is by consciousness. And then he went on to say that what the mind has created cannot either make the mind or destroy the mind, and he drew the conclusion that mind must be eternal, that actually there is no beginning or end to it. Then tying that into trying to understand this physical universe that we're in, which began at a Big Bang. So space and matter have a beginning, but consciousness doesn't have a beginning. What is space? Space, after all, is just another word. By space, of course, I don't just mean sort of outer space. I mean the room in which things exist. So the space around us now, the space which we are in, is also space. That what actually is that? If you take it down to its root in an analysis, basically space is separation of points. Okay.
So space is geometry.
With separation. Geometry can only exist when there's separation. So before, if you don't have a Big Bang, then you have no separation. So you have consciousness. You have us as beings, or being, if you like, if we have no beginning or end.
Okay, tell you what, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. I got to do some things here. I've got a really, I hope, pithy question to talk to you about Big Bangs when we come back. My guest this evening, wherever you are, is Dr. Andrew Silberman. We're discussing the Shroud of Turin as a segue into a much larger question. How was it created? Is it a part of physics that is currently unknown? And does that physics ultimately include the idea of consciousness of us and how many countless other beings in a universe? And we'll expand on that when we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
Thanks for listening to this exciting first hour. Now, the second and third hour of the show is available to Club 19.5 members only. Please support the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 and join our very interesting community. To do that, please visit the website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the left-hand column. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350-plus shows that we have done. Now, recent Club 19.5 member archive recording have the commercials removed, and the sound quality has been enhanced. You'll also receive a dedicated private podcast feed that contains these enhanced show recordings. And you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the archive if you prefer. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll also be the first to preview our new videos and reports. We'll be adding exclusive new features to Club 19.5 as we go forward, and boy, have we got some amazing things to tell you about in the coming weeks. So please support the show and don't miss all the exciting new things we have planned. I want to thank all our Club 19.5 members because without your guys' support, this show would not be on the air. Please help us continue growing the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 today. And when I say we really need you, we really need you. Over and out.